Welcome back to MERS Monday, for more than 10 years, the Michigan political podcast. In this week's edition of MERS Monday, Executive Director Abby Mitch of Michigan Rising Action and State Representative Jason Morgan, the Michigan Democratic Party's vice chair, discuss what they believe have been the most underreported stories of 2023 so far. State Senator Kevin Hertel, a St. Clair Shores Democrat, explains why he believes the legislature won't adjourn early this year. As chair of the Senate Health Policy Committee, Hertel wants to spend the fall dedicated to legislation transitioning Michigan to a state-based health insurance exchange marketplace. Additionally, Midwest Advocacy Manager Courtney Burgoyne of Evergreen Action describes why environmentalists are excited about a report finding that Michigan could attract nearly $8 billion in extra federal investment if lawmakers approve new carbon-free energy policies. Now, here's MERS reporter Samantha Schreiber, MERS House reporter Danielle James, and MERS editor Kyle Malin.
Thank you so much, Mark Bayshore, for kicking off today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast, where we have some pretty expansive segments ranging from energy policy to fighter aircraft to, believe it or not, Lake St. Clair boat parties, which I may or may not know anything about. But I am especially excited for our first roundtable segment with Abigail Mitch, the latest executive director of Michigan Rising Action, a conservative principles organization, and State Representative Jason Morgan, an Ann Arbor Democrat and the vice chair of the Michigan Democratic Party. How are you all doing today?
Doing great. Glad to be here with you.
Yeah, doing great, Sam. Thanks for being here. Nice to see you, Jason.
Yeah, good to see you.
Now, before everybody gets too rowdy, I want to clarify that this isn't intended to be a debate, but a politically multidimensional conversation. But if you two want to compete for the MERS quote of the day, it would be completely out of my power to stop you two. But I invited you two today to ask some questions that have been particularly on our minds at MERS. We are also with our House reporter, Danielle James, today. And the first question is, what has been, in your individual opinions, the most overblown story in Michigan for 2023 so far? Abby, what do you think?
I think the most overblown story in Michigan so far has been the idea of Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin as a walk-in Senate candidate replacement for Debbie Stout. Now, I think that was the early narrative, and you're now seeing that curve flatten out as more candidates join the field. And in my opinion, Congressman Slotkin really struggles to find her statewide footing and appeal.
What about you, Jason? What do you think?
I'd say the most overblown story has been the brouhaha regarding hate crimes legislation that passed the House. I think it's a very simple piece of legislation that adds LGBTQ protections against violence toward people targeted to a specific group. It seems like something that we should actually be able to all agree on as a bipartisan effort to say you shouldn't enact violence on any people, but especially not because of some part of who they are or what their identity is. So I'd say that's the most overblown story.
Sorry, I'll level with you on that. But to the extent that I don't understand how it has factored in as a population attraction data point for the governor's office, that is profoundly confusing to me. I am in my mid-30s. I have moved a lot of times, and never once have I considered anything other than job prospects and is my family anywhere and people I love anywhere nearby in choosing a move. I really think, and honestly, they've struggled to even find a data point that would convince you that some of the things like this hate crime legislation even blip on people's radars when they think about moving to Michigan.
I don't want to make any presumptions about your identity as a person, but I would say that you probably aren't the target demographic that would be impacted by this. So as somebody who is LGBTQ, I absolutely made a decision about where I wanted to live based on wanting to be in a safe and welcoming and accepting place. So for me, I grew up in Michigan and lived in DC for a short bit and decided, where in the world do I want to live? Picked Michigan. Despite the fact that it was not an LGBTQ-friendly place at the time, and picked Ann Arbor, Michigan, because it seemed like the only place that truly was in the state that I love. Nowadays, I feel like we're at a place where people can live anywhere in our state, and feel far more welcome and accepted than they ever have been.
Yeah, I mean, if you're Pete Buttigieg, you live in Traverse City. But my point is, show me the data to back it up as population attraction. I don't want to debate your experience or anyone else's, but if we're going to spend the state money and time on the population commission where this is a talking point, I think we deserve to see what's driving that, other than partisan politics potentially.
Now, I'm going to make a transition over. What do you think has been the most underreported on story of 2023 so far, Jason?
Oh, I have a whole list. So I will start with one. I guess I would first say, I think the most underreported or undercovered has been just how adorable my fiance is. He's been on the House floor with me several times, and too few of my colleagues have noticed this delightful addition that I brought to the floor. I'm also increasing Michigan's population by bringing a new citizen into our state. So I'm really doing my part above and beyond here, and nobody has noticed this. I'm kidding, of course. But my colleagues, I think, have actually noticed and preferred that he stay on the floor and then I leave, actually. But no, I think one of the most undercovered stories that I've seen really has been the despite the fact that we are a pro-LGBTQ legislature and governor, Michigan Republicans are still introducing harmful and bigoted legislation regularly to try and engage us in this culture war nationally, rather than staying focused on the real problems that Michigan families are facing each day. Just a couple of votes in the House and the Senate make the difference between us going full Ron DeSantis and attacking our citizens, pushing businesses out, and undoing the work of making this a really appealing place here in the legislature. I think that's undercovered, because if we had just a couple of votes one way or the other, you'd be looking at a wildly different Michigan right now than what we're seeing today.
Abby, before you answer, do you want to respond to that?
Sure. I guess I'm sort of confused where we get off blaming Republicans still for any lack of progress in helping Michigan thrive economically. Democrats control the governor's office, secretary of state, attorney general, Senate, House. Doesn't get any easier to pass things than that, unless, of course, the undercovered story is what is more or less an open secret in Lansing, which is that House Democrats are struggling to organize themselves as an effective majority. The budget process sort of tipped the hand of that quite clearly. They're about to lose this slim majority and lose two members, and that's I've seen a few stories come about this week. And then, of course, we are sort of glossing past the fact that Democrats in the legislature are planning to sine die early in order to make the cut for the early presidential primary. So if there's anyone abandoning duty here to our state, I would argue that it's the majority party wanting to walk out a couple months early.
Okay, I need to respond to that. I didn't reference anything related to any of that. What I'm talking about is that I think the undercover story here is that all of the things the Republicans would be doing if they were in charge and if they were in power, and I think they are directly contrary to what the actual citizens would want us to be doing. People want us to be a more welcoming state, and economically, the numbers do show that it's better if we are a welcoming, accepting state for diverse people. But even aside from that, the economics of what we're doing in Michigan right now are things are working in Michigan. We have one of the lowest unemployment rates in history. Governor Whitmer's actions over the last several years are clearly paying off with more jobs, more economic development, prospering communities, higher local property tax revenue. You're seeing in every Under every metric, Michigan is doing better economically than many states right now. And I think that's directly related to the actions that we're taking as the legislature. And I will say on the budget, that was a phenomenal process in terms of the timeline and how effectively it was done. As somebody who was directly involved in that process, I can assure you it was thorough and it was exhausting, but it got the right result because of the hard work that we put into it.
I'm just curious, you know, before anyone else responds, if you could give us a few specific examples of what kind of legislation you're referencing when you're talking about, you know, these harmful cases.
Yeah, absolutely. There are, I believe, 8 anti-trans bills in Michigan right now that have been introduced, in addition to bills related to abortion protections. So while we literally had citizens say that they want us to protect the basic right to abortion, we still have bills. I think it was Gina Johnson introduced a bill that would restrict the right to abortion, and there are several others as well. That would do that too. So even though we're passing all these really progressive things in Michigan in terms of access to basic healthcare and rights in Michigan, if we had one or two votes going the opposite direction, we would look more like Florida. And you can see that by the legislation that Republicans are introducing that aren't getting covered because they're in a minority.
So I guess where I want to go here is, one, I think this some of the points you made about the governor's economic progress, let's point out that so far 2/3 of her career as governor has been with the partnership of a Republican majority. So anything that she's signed has come from the Republican caucus. And I think credit where credit is due on that one. Second, I think we need to dial back to the idea of basic needs. I mean, right now, I mean, the city you live in is struggling to keep the lights on to the tune of businesses shuttering their doors because DTE cannot keep power going to Ann Arbor. I mean, we have some mission critical basic life. I mean, like in the sort of like Malthusian order of needs, we are completely failing at the bottom of the pyramid here of having basic shelter, power, roads to get where we need to go. And I think that needs to be the center focus. And I'm pretty sure most Michiganders would agree, especially as the state makes this turn towards joining the electric vehicle movement forward, where that is going to put significant stress on our roads, on our infrastructure. And we've got to learn to walk and chew gum at the same time real quick if we're going to make that switch.
Abby, I think there's actually a really important point of agreement here. I think we should all be able to agree that our utilities in Michigan are doing a bad job and they're failing us, specifically DTE, which is what I see in my region in Southeast Michigan. DTE, despite earning record profits, $6.3 billion reported in June, and underinvesting in their infrastructure, they're asking for a rate increase. That is appalling to me. I think we should all be in agreement that this is an unacceptable level of service. And you are absolutely right that one of the most basic needs that we have is keeping the lights on and the power on for all of the different needs that we have. And we need to do something on that. The House Dems have been doing a listening tour with their Republican counterparts throughout the state over the summer. I believe that will conclude here at the end of August. And I sincerely hope and frankly demand that we actually do something to hold the utilities more accountable this fall. If we don't, I think that's a failure of the entire legislature if we don't do something to make sure that people have better access to keeping their lights on. And what I've heard so far from the listening tour is that people are saying they want affordable power, they want reliable power, and they want renewable energy. These are the three things that are coming out of that listening tour, as I've heard so far. I think these are...
I don't doubt that at all. I'm sure they also would tell you puppies are cute and the sky is blue. I mean, the issue here is that for years, MISO and the power companies were telling the state, the governor's office, that we do not have enough infrastructure to sustain our power load. Please do not add more. And still the governor pushed to pull Palisades offline, which provides a significant amount of energy into our grid. And then all of a sudden we start to shut down Palisades, find out we're having rolling brownouts and issues across the state. And then we pull it back online. And this is one of my underrated stories, is no one has covered that you can't just bring a nuclear plant back online. That's like reusing a water balloon. I mean, once you've started the shutdown process, you are stuck. And that is an expensive and devastating problem for this state.
Now, I do want to pivot over because we have Danielle James with us today, and she has some questions regarding the presidential race. What happens if there's a Biden versus Trump matchup again?
Yes. I guess, you know, looking at some of the recent surveying we've seen, it seems like Americans, you know, aren't necessarily sold on a Trump versus Biden election. why does it seem like that's what we're going to get?
It all depends on who turns out for the primary. And data shows that when Americans broadly aren't excited about the candidate in front of them, the highest propensity voters who don't often share the majority opinion are the ones who turn out to vote in the primary. It's that simple. I just say don't necessarily share the majority opinion.
Yeah. I mean, I'd say if everyone who has benefited from Joe Biden's policies showed up to vote, that he would win by a landslide. I think a lot of folks are not always excited about somebody, a leader who is stable and doing a good job and getting things done in the same way that they are as something new, fresh, and exciting. But I think it is unequivocal that Joe Biden is doing a phenomenal job for our country. And I think people will see that and turn out to vote, especially if it's against Donald Trump again.
Does Joe Biden want to pay my grocery bill? Because I have not benefited from Biden's policy.
Abby, before we dive into that good stuff, you know, I mean, I'm assuming that you would vote in the Republican presidential primary in 2024. And with that being said, I mean, is it concerning that because of, you know, where we are right now in an early presidential primary, that Republicans are poised to lose delegates depending on how they utilize that February date that Democrats have proposed? Is that concerning for you? Is that concerning for you when it comes to turnout in this presidential primary for Republicans?
I appreciate that question. I'm kind of a purist when it comes to electing presidents. I'm not afraid of how democracy can and should work. Whatever games get played at the committee and convention level in order to benefit one candidate or the other, ultimately, I believe in the system our founding fathers created and made the best candidate win.
But Jason, for you, I mean, obviously, Democrats right now are excited about having an early presidential primary in Michigan for their party. And I know that given your role with the MDP, that you are a DNC delegate, correct?
Now,
I mean, is that concerning for you when it comes to, you know, I mean, Michigan, we have a lot of purple voters. We have a lot of ticket splitters. A lot of them are really excited to participate in this Republican presidential primary, even though they may not vote Republican in a general election. I mean, are you concerned about, you know, what having that early primary will do to the Republican vote?
Absolutely. So I would say, one, I am so excited that we are finally moving up Michigan in the primary process after years of needing to. I think Michigan is a perfect state to be early in the process based on our purple status, the role we play nationally, how important our economy is to the region, and the diversity of our state. I think we are a perfect example of a state that should have a bigger influence in the national process. So I think that is so important. And I do think that it is important that the Republican Party also acknowledge that in the same way that the Democratic Party has. This moving Michigan up in the primary process is a direct result of the National Democratic Party understanding the value of Michigan and how important we are, and wanting to make sure that we are prioritized in that process. There is still a choice in what the Republican Party chooses to do with us moving up our primary. The National Republican Party can absolutely allow Michigan to move forward, understand that it wasn't necessarily the Michigan Republican Party's planning or idea, or, you know, it's not their fault, and not punish them for something that wasn't their choice. We're not trying to punish anyone through this process. It would only be the National Republican Party who would choose to do that.
It would generally be my preference that our lawmakers stayed in their seats in Lansing rather than jet off to deal with partisan politics. But, you know.
The other part I should mention on this is that in 2008, I was the youngest Michigan delegate. I was an alternate delegate for Hillary Clinton in 2008. And that was a year when Michigan Democrats moved up the primary. And in that year, the National Democratic Party did penalize us 50% of our vote value. It was unfortunate. I wasn't thrilled about it. It is very interesting to go from being someone who would protest at a DNC committee meeting to being a DNC committee member now. That is really exciting. because I didn't think it was right that they did that back then. But I do think that this is an acknowledgement of the value of our state. And I really do sincerely hope that the National Republican Party observes what happened in the past and says, you know, we really need to make sure that Michigan is valued too. I really hope that they will do that.
I'm going to kind of transition away again, and I apologize because I think that is a really interesting point as well. But, you know, I'm curious if you believe, I'll start with Jason this time. Do you believe the American public is getting more polarized, and is that a problem?
I think the American public does seem to be getting more polarized. And I think that is the result of direct efforts by, frankly, right-wing politicians and strategists trying to sway these folks to believe in crazy conspiracy theories online. If you look at the world of conspiracy theories online about every kooky idea in the world, you will see that there is a strong concerted effort to polarize people in our country in a way that I have not seen on the left. Maybe I'm just not a great target for it or what, but I have not seen any wild and crazy YouTube videos trying to convince me of crazy conspiracies. I think that's playing a big role because you have really good people who would otherwise just be your average voter who votes whichever way they feel like in each election, who are being indoctrinated. And so it's, I think, having a larger impact on the broader population because these folks are believing really crazy stuff.
What do you think, Gabby?
I think that in my journalism classes in college, I remember learning the phrase, if it bleeds, it leads. And I think that largely as opportunity for people to interact in real time in community spaces as human beings, not political objects, has decreased significantly over the last few years. You are seeing people interact with the world through these large national media who have a vested interest in creating conflicts and controversy. And all you have to do is flip through your three major broadcast news networks in the morning to see that you can find a potpourri of hatred for Biden, hatred for Trump, both of their mutual legal problems. And I don't think that does anything to move forward a reasonable conversation among individuals about what would best grow our economy, make people want to move to Michigan to fill the incredible number of high quality jobs that are available in really nice communities across this state. I do have some concern. I don't know if more polarized is the right way to address it, but I think fewer venues for consensus is probably the problem.
I would agree. I think we need more dialogue with people in person, which is very different than online. When you're talking to somebody, even over a video like this, it is so much more personal than posting things on Twitter or something like that. Like this, frankly, I will probably never be a MERS quote of the day because I just don't like being snarky in the way that you probably need to be to have a thought caught in one headline. There's so much nuance to everything that we do that requires people to be nicer. And we are nicer when we are talking to people that we can see as opposed to some like a internet abyss. My family, a lot of my family are Trump supporters, and I still love all of them. And we have great conversations, and we still love each other, despite the fact that we have very different politics. And that's okay. I recently had lunch with Senator Runstead because we share the city of South Lyon, representing them in the legislature. And we had a delightful conversation over coffee and I think grilled cheeses at this great little spot in South Lyon. And we agree on a lot of the basic problems that Michigan is facing and the goal that we would want to have for addressing some of these things. We don't necessarily agree on the cause of the problems or the, every detail, but we do agree with the overall value that people need to have a fair shot. We need more ethical government. We need to do better at taking on the big corporate interests that have so much influence in Michigan politics. And that's great. We had a phenomenal conversation. publicly, you will generally see us being on very different sides of all of the hot button issues. And so that's the issues I really care about for the most part are generally not the hot button issues. It's like education, infrastructure, good investments in the things that we need in government, like that kind of stuff.
No, unfortunately, we definitely went over time here, which I'm so sad about. I'm heartbroken about because I have a treasure chest of questions I would have loved to ask you both. But thank you all so much for participating in this conversation. It did not get as feisty as it could have gotten. And I love that.
Well, I'm gonna blame Jason for that one. He brought on like one of the nicest people around.
Even when feisty, I still believe in being nice, which doesn't lend you to being like a wild and exciting person. But I just think, you know, Abby's pretty cool. Even though we disagree and we have like our jobs to do, it's pretty, I don't know, there's just no reason to be mean.
Yeah, if you want to get grilled cheese with me sometime, Jason, I'd be totally cool with that.
That'd be great.
Well, thank you all so much for joining today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Now I'm cheesing when you blow past, yeah. If you take a slice of me, it's all alright with me. Oh boy, I never see the smile in your eyes. Yeah, for this segment, we are joined by Senator Kevin Hertel, a St. Clair Shores Democrat representing the Lake St. Clair 12-state Senate District. He's also the chair of the Senate Health Policy Committee and the Senate Appropriations Subcommittee on Military Veterans and State Police. You know, I really want to kick off today's segment, Senator Hertel. And by the way, thank you so much for joining us today. But I really want to kick off today, you know, discussing health policy. Now that we're in the second half of 2023, I'm interested in asking, what are this year's health policy goals and what legislation should we be on the lookout for?
Well, first, thank you so much for having me. This is my first time ever being on the MERS podcast, so I am honored to be here with you. In fact, the last time my name was probably mentioned on this podcast was when Senator Nesbitt said my campaign was a passion project for the Senate Democrats, which obviously we were able to win and take majority of the Senate. But, you know, the Health Policy Committee has been very active this year. I think we've gotten a lot of great things done. We've taken up some very important issues, but we have a lot more left on the plate that we want to look at. I think you'll see in the fall, one of our priorities, one of my personal priorities, is to get the state-based exchange passed so that we bring the health exchange from the feds back here into the state, which will create more efficiencies for the state, some savings that we can probably reinvest into Healthy Michigan, but also creates a no-wrong-door policy that will allow people who are either applying for Medicaid or plan on the exchange a pathway into the right product for them. And so we're looking forward to hopefully moving that in the fall, getting that through the Senate and hopefully through the House by the end of the year so that the department can start working on that and go out to bid in a year or two here. We also want to work on some issues around staffing, you know, really specifically in our hospital settings. We know there is a critical staffing shortage across all of our hospitals in the state. But also and really across the entire medical sector, whether you're talking about nursing homes or, you know, primary care offices, we're seeing a shortage and it's impacting care for people across the entire state. And so we want to look and see how we can be helpful with that, whether there's some issues around scope, and, you know, tough issues to tackle, but in career pathways and all kinds of different things that we can look at to make sure that not only do we have the staffing we need today, but that 10 years from now, we will have the staffing to properly provide care across the state of Michigan. And then another thing we want to look at is the mental health needs across the state. You know, in the state budget, we had $40 million go to Macomb County to build a new intake center at the Macomb County Jail, which will better assess mental health needs and substance abuse when somebody is brought to that facility. And really with the a mind towards getting them the care that they need instead of just, you know, putting somebody in a cell and not helping them through whatever is going on at that moment. We think that's probably a model that can be used across the state because unfortunately, a lot of individuals with mental health needs or substance abuse needs, they're showing up at our jails. The Wayne County Jail continually is one of the largest mental health providers in the entire state. And that's mainly just because they're the largest jail. Every other jail is not far behind them. And really something that's really close to my heart is adolescent mental health, making sure, and you saw in this budget as well, in the school aid budget, that there was a eye towards providing more mental health care, more dollars for mental health care in our school systems. That's something that's incredibly important, to make sure that we can identify when there's a mental health issue with a young adult, with a teen, with a younger child, early on, and then get them the help they need and give them the tools that they can use later in life to deal with some of those issues. So, you know, I think there's a myriad of issues we want to look at. They're all big issues, and we're excited to tackle some of them when we get back in the fall.
You know, during this summer recess, there's been a lot of conversations around the Federal Inflation Reduction Act and how it does things like require drug companies to finance rebates to Medicare for drug prices that rise faster than the inflation rate, and cap monthly cost sharing for insulin at $35 for individuals covered by Medicare. And I wonder, on the state level in your own committee, is there anything your committee wants to do to bring similar reform to Michigan for non-Medicare covered residents?
Yeah, so I think we have to remember that what was passed by Congress in recent years is still being implemented, right? And so we do want to see what the impact of that is in terms of savings, in terms of reducing prescription drug costs. Some of that's still left to be seen as the implementation dates come forward. There's no doubt that we will look at some policy around pharmaceutical drugs. I think everybody has somebody in their family who is struggling to afford the medicines that they need to live. And I see some of it in my own family as well, as my mother-in-law is on oral chemo and it has saved her life, but it's very expensive. And at this point, it's not approved. She's on Medicare, so the feds don't require it to be covered. In the state, we're going to look at what we can do to pass the oral chemo legislation that came out of the House and make sure that insurance companies here in Michigan are covering that specific drug. But I think we're gonna take a holistic approach and see what we can do to try to find savings for folks across the state. The challenge being that a lot of this has to be done at the federal level. We've seen many states that have passed all kinds of different mechanisms to try to reduce prescription drug costs in their state. And we haven't really seen the outcome to this point that actually reduces a lot of those costs. And so I wish Congress would get their act together and pass some meaningful legislation, but I'm not that hopeful. The more and more I see Congress spending more time on all kinds of other useless things and politics that don't actually impact families across all of our districts. So we've got to do what we can here in the state, and we'll do that. But I think this has got to be a much larger conversation for our country.
Senator, what have you heard in regards to adjourning early this year, adjourning sine die, so that the presidential primary legislation will go into effect by February 27?
I've heard a lot of people, in town talking about it.
I get emails all the time. Everybody wants to know what's going on.
Yeah, I think it's this rumor that's been floating around since the spring, right? And there's no doubt that people are concerned. And, you know, look, I don't think any one of, you know, the leadership, Speaker Tate and Majority Leader Brinks, I don't think they decided to run for those positions to give up any of their time to get things done. And so from what I see right now, I think we'll be in session and continuing to do what we've done this entire legislative session to this point. That's getting really critical policies passed. You know, look, if you look, you know, at the time that I've been in the legislature for the last 6.5 years, or really over the last 2 decades, we've had probably one of the most productive sessions that I can recall. And I think we want to continue that work, and we're not willing to give up any time that we do have.
So you would be surprised if you don't adjourn, you know, last week in December.
Yeah, I think we're going to be here and doing the work that we need to do.
Okay.
Not including special sessions called for by the governor?
I would not want our agenda to be driven in that way. And so I hope that we'll be there running our own agenda and working on the legislative policies that so many of us ran for office in order to work on. To be honest, it was a very busy spring in session. And so there were many things that we were working on that were big issues that force us to wait on some of the other issues that we really want to work on. For me personally, bringing the federal exchange here into the state is an issue that I am really focused on. But because of everything else we had to deal with earlier this year, we've waited till the fall to take that up. And I want to make sure that we have the time to get something like that done. And I know many other members have priorities as well.
I know while we do have Robert F. Kennedy Jr. as a challenger against Joe Biden, I mean, right now it seems that an early presidential primary, it would give a lot of success to Joe Biden as the incumbent. So would you dare say that an early presidential primary for Democrats is not worth an early signee die?
To me, it's not even about the politics. It's about making sure we're getting the work done here in the state legislature. Politics for me is always obviously a part of this process, but I try to focus on what we need to do to get things done. And that's really where I'm focused on. I haven't spent a lot of time thinking about early signing die. While I've heard about it in town, you know, I think almost every conversation I have right now, it comes up because people are nervous and they want to understand what timeline we're working on. But look, I think we'll be there in October and November and December doing the work that needs to get done. And the other stuff will just have to work itself out.
I saw that the House office building is installing metal detectors or something to screen out guns. Would you be in favor of doing something similar for the Binsfield building?
You know, I think I'm going to leave that decision up to the Capitol Commission. Obviously, they've made the decision in the Capitol and others that over the Senate Business Office and those who see the day-to-day operations of that building. There's no doubt that in recent history, we've seen a lot more threats towards elected members. I've received some of those during my time in the House through the pandemic and when we were working on gun legislation earlier this year, saw some of those things come across our office. And so I think it's a very tense time in politics anywhere. Unfortunately, this is what, we see more and more of these threats occurring, more and more dangerous situations. The rhetoric continues to get amped up. And so I wish we didn't have to do that, but I think it's, those who are charged with making sure that not only us as senators, but the staff that work in those buildings are safe. And that's really where our focus should be, to make sure those who come to work every single day to do the work that's required to represent our districts and get our constituents the service that they need, that they're safe. And so, I think this is a step that does help some feel safe when they're coming to work and they have real concerns. And I think they're valid.
So what are you going to do about your gun when you go into the Capitol?
I don't carry a gun into the Capitol. Oh, okay. I never have. All right. I never felt that I needed to either. So it won't impact me one bit.
Now, I do want to change the conversation a bit to Selfridge Air National Guard Base, which is obviously in your district. I know that it was appropriated $10 million in the state budget to improve and maintain infrastructure to make Michigan more competitive for next generation aircraft and future fighter missions. When you talk about bringing a special fighter mission to Selfridge in Macomb County, what exactly does that mean?
So the A-10 is being decommissioned, and that's what's currently at Selfridge Air National Guard Base today. The Air Force believes that by 2026, 2027, those will no longer be in use for any mission in the Air Force. They do also have a small contingent of refueling tankers, and they actually just received some new ones. So that mission is ongoing there, but it's tough to sustain a base of that size with simply that one tanker mission. We know that the base is at risk if we can't get a mission in there that will go well into the future. And not only the base, Michigan also has one of the largest areas of protected airspace anywhere east of the Mississippi. And so that's a huge asset to not only the Selfridge, but to all the military innovation that goes on in our state. And we want to make sure we protect that. If you were to lose the base, I would be certain that the FAA and others would start to chip away at that airspace. And we would be at risk of losing that as well. And so it's critical that we get another mission at Selfridge. That's why we've been working so hard, not only through my office, and I know members of the House in a bipartisan fashion, as well as the United States Senate and the United States House have been working so hard to get this done. There's an issue at Selfridge where there's a clearing zone the Air Force requires around the runway. It's really a safety mechanism. There are homes that are located in that clearing zone today. Now, the Air Force in years past was able to look past that. They would give simply a waiver and still locate things here, given that clear zone issue. But I think those days are pretty much over. I think the Air Force is looking at other areas that don't have that issue. In fact, Selfridge has been in the running for an F-35 in multiple occasions now, and has come in second. And the likely biggest issue is because of that clear zone, or those homes that are within that clear zone. And so we are working on a project that simply moves that runway, shifts it to the north so that we can get those homes out of that clear zone, have what the Air Force is looking for. And I think once we do that, Selfridge will be the most competitive base for another fighter mission anywhere in the country, given its location, the protected airspace that we have here in Michigan, and the many different training bonuses that we have with all kinds of different terrain across the state. You know, you can be out of Selfridge and over Lake Huron very quickly. You can also be up north in different situations as well. So it works very well for training. And so we want to do everything we can as a state to invest and make sure the feds have a base here that they can locate a mission at.
So what do you think about Curtis Sertel, your brother, running for Congress?
I said early on when it was a question of if he would run or not, that if he runs, he's going to win. Because I don't, you know, he campaigns harder than anybody I've ever met. In fact, you know, I've learned so much from him during my time in elected office and campaigning. He'll work 10 times harder than I've ever worked. I've seen it. So I wouldn't want to be anybody running against him. So probably many of the people who are listening to this podcast today have already gotten a call from him asking for money, because I know he's been working very hard. But I think he'll do a great job representing that seat. And he's uniquely qualified to go to Washington, D.C. and take on the nonsense that we're seeing today.
I mean, it's going to be different, though. I mean, you kind of liked him being in town. He was lobbying you for 6 months, and now now he could be shipped off to D.C. You won't see him as much. That's a blessing. I don't know.
No, I enjoy working with Curtis. Obviously, the brother dynamic always makes it a little bit more interesting, but and we disagree on issues sometimes. We've had to have tough conversations, even in this session. But, you know, we always understand that my district is very different than any district he's represented to this point. We have different areas, different priorities, and we try to work together the best we can to get to a positive outcome.
Who's better at fantasy baseball or football?
Oh, I wouldn't even try to, you know, I try to compete with him, to be honest. I mean, that and horse racing, I let him handle. I'm more of a,
he's got you both, huh?
I'm more of a hockey guy. So,
okay. You know, I do want to ask in relation to elections. I mean, you won a general election last November by 404 votes, where campaign literature highlighted your moderate political activities. However, this year you have taken policy votes that will look very good on a Democratic scorecard. Have any of your constituents challenged you on your moderate identity?
I don't know, not specifically on my moderate identity. In fact, I mean, to be honest with you, I think a lot of the things that we tackled early this session are things that are pretty in the middle. Obviously, there are some things that you know, the other side is angry about, but I think there are things that people across the state want to see done. You know, I have coffee hours frequently across my district. I'm out in the district every single day, meeting with constituents, and are there things that people are angry about? There's no doubt. I mean, I think we've taken on some issues that people feel very passionate about one way or the other. But I find when you can sit down and talk with somebody and have a conversation, you can sometimes figure out you're not as far apart as you might've thought you were. The gun bills that we took up were a perfect example where I'd have individuals come to a coffee hour. They would be very upset about something that they might've read on the internet or somebody told them that they thought the bills would do. And we would have a sometimes heated, but very focused conversation on the issue and talk about the facts. And I would get out the legislation, the bills, and we'd go over some of the wording. And many individuals at the end of those conversations would say, well, gosh, these really aren't that bad, given what, you know, what we're talking about here. So I think it's, you know, obviously it's a challenge. There's a lot of misinformation that gets put out there for political reasons. We've seen that time and time again in this session from the other side, whether that was, the pension tax repeal and some of the things that they were saying that weren't truthful about that, whether it were the gun bills and trying to make them as they were trying to paint them as extreme as they possibly could. And really, I think they're reasonable and sound policy. You know, we continue to see this push from some on the other side to try to make everything The sky is falling. You know, these things are so horrible. But I think when you actually sit down and talk with folks about how they impact our communities, about how they impact their own pocketbooks, that they understand the benefit to some of it. And we have to get past some of this politics and actually focus on the things that have to get done.
How seriously concerned are you of having a recall effort against you once you become eligible to be recalled?
I'm not concerned. Like I said, the politics are the politics. Obviously, we will be prepared for that if somebody so chooses to file it. But we have worked since January in the seat. We have been all across this district. We have worked with local officials who are Republican, Democrat, Independent, to get real meaningful things done. Just yesterday, I was at a press conference with the chairman of the Macomb County Board, Don Brown, who's a Republican, with Candace Miller, our Public Works Commissioner, and a local mayor, and talking through some of the projects we've worked on to reduce combined sewer flows into Lake St. Clair. We were on Harson's Island with a township supervisor and a large group of people talking about a really critical water infrastructure project up there. We've been across this district talking about the things that actually matter to people, and we've knocked over 7,000 doors in this summer alone, just going out and talking with residents about the work that we've done and what they want to see done going forward in the future. So I will always be prepared for those political tactics, because I'm sure somebody will use them when they see a benefit to them. But I'm not concerned, because I feel like we've done the work, we've built the relationships, and really are getting a good response from residents in this district. And so, you know, if I had to be on the ballot again, maybe it's not a 404 vote victory. Maybe we win by, 600 or 700 votes this time. We're trying to do everything we can in a targeted way to build relationships that will lead to a lasting impact down the road.
We did go a little bit over, but I have to ask, because I feel like no one is more tired of hearing me say that I'm from St. Clair Shores than you are, Senator Hertel. I feel like every time I see you, I'm like, I live right by you. But I have to ask, because we are pre-recording this segment. We're pre-recording it on Thursday, August 10th. Senator Hertel, are you going to raft off to engage with your constituents? A lot of them are going to be there.
I am sure a lot of my constituents will be at the raft off this weekend. Thousands of people, and not only my constituents, people from all over the state and the region, but I will not be there this year. I might be on the boat somewhere enjoying some time, but I don't know if we'll make it over to that area of the lake. It's a pretty good boat ride across the lake, and it all depends on the winds and how great of a ride you can have that day. So, but I hope everybody has a safe and enjoyable time, and we always want people to come and see Lake St. Clair. I think it's one of the crown jewels of our state, you know, a huge economic impact for this region, but one of the most beautiful places of anywhere in our great state. And so I always welcome people to come and enjoy it. And I think many people will take up that invitation this weekend.
Yeah. Do you think there will be more jello shots taken than dollars spent in your state Senate race against Pam Hornberger?
You know, it'll be close, I think. I can only imagine the amount of jello shots that will be out there this weekend. We just hope people consume safely, and that, you know, it's always great after that weekend if we don't have any major incidents. And so I hope we have a safe weekend out there. People have fun, enjoy the lake with their families, and we don't see anything happen. But that's a great question, and I'm gonna have to think about that a little bit.
Thank you so much, Senator Hertel, for joining us on today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
I knew just what it had to be when I heard you say what you said to me. To every dude in sight, look like you're working up an appetite for the night jacket. By then I just sat at the back, peeping you out the way you act. Every string attack, getting out of line, and I'm yanking you back in your place. All is well and all is cool.
So we are now on our final interview of the MERS Monday podcast and are joined by Courtney Burgoyne, the Senior Policy and Advocacy Manager for Evergreen Action, the Climate Action and Clean Energy Economic Development Organization in the Midwest. How are you today, Courtney?
I'm doing well. Thank you so much for having me.
No, thank you so much for joining us. I mean, a huge reason why we have Courtney on today is because Evergreen Action recently had a report published, which was prepared by Five Lake Energy and the Michigan Energy Innovation Business Council, on how Michigan can improve its advantages in accessing more than $50 billion, billion of a B, in competitive grant funding offered through the Federal Inflation Reduction Act that was approved by Congress last year. Your report states that if Michigan lawmakers approve policies to transition Michigan's electricity generation to 100% carbon-free sources, including nuclear power by 2035, as well as to increase the state's energy waste reduction targets to 2% electric efficiency and 1.5% gas efficiency annually in commercial, industrial, and residential spaces, Michigan would be poised to obtain a total of $14.7 billion, again, billion for B, in federal IRA investment through 2050. But Courtney, I have you on here today because I am so curious about where these numbers came from and why are you so confident that these are, for certain, the dollar amounts that Michigan can access through substantial policy changes?
Yeah, so that's a great question. I think we know there's that grant money on the table, which you mentioned, that $50 billion, but there's also these uncapped tax credits. So to build out renewable energy sources, there's uncapped tax credits available for that. So we actually don't know how much money is going to be dealt out for that. But we do know when states set pretty aggressive clean energy standards, more of those tax credits are going to be used in those states. So that's kind of where the multiplier effect comes in. We also know that the federal government is looking at competitive applications for those $50 billion in grants that you talked about that have really two goals in mind. One being, okay, how much carbon emissions are they reducing? And the second piece is, is your project proposal benefiting communities? And we know kind of these policies are put in place to accomplish both of those goals. One, obviously, 100% clean energy standard will significantly reduce our emissions from the power sector, but also things like the Public Service Commission reform. That's going to ensure that communities are benefiting from cheaper, cleaner, more reliable power. So these policies in place and having that policy infrastructure there is going to signal to the federal government that Michigan is serious about helping the nation meet our climate goals and create benefits for communities and grow their economy. So that grant funding and those uncapped tax credits really working together to create a multiplier effect because of those state policies.
So what is the definition of investment in this report? Are we talking credits? Are we talking direct awards that might have some clawback agreements? What exactly is the definition here?
So all of the above. We're looking at the private sector investment that's possible. So the tax credits for renewable energy, the rebates that consumers can access to put solar on their roofs or get heat pumps in their homes to make them more efficient. And then also those competitive grants. So things like the Solar for All competition and the climate pollution reduction grants, that money is specifically, a large portion of that money is specifically earmarked for states. And they'll be competing for that through application. So again, the federal government is kind of looking for those really competitive applications that cut carbon emissions and create community benefits. So all of those things into one. And there's a lot of IRA programs that I probably can't read off in list by list, but there's a lot of money on the table to put it into perspective.
I want to focus in specifically on, community and rooftop solar. I was at a Grand Rapids listening session hosted by Rep. Fitzgerald. I covered that, and a lot of people testifying there were concerned that the way Michigan's cap on rooftop solar and community solar, or lack of it, are set up, that, that will also be a stopping agent in collecting some of this federal grant money. What can you say about that?
Yeah, definitely. There's kind of a set of solar policies that need to be either undone or put into place to kind of elevate Michigan's competitiveness in that application for the Solar for All money. So definitely that distributed generation cap. Having that cap doesn't allow as much solar to get online as we know is possible right now because of the technology that exists and just the super low cost of solar energy at this stage. So undoing that cap will open the market for a lot more solar to get online. There's also things like putting a storage target in place in the state. Having that target, again, is going to increase the demand for building out storage systems in the state. So again, these policies are kind of working in coordination with each other to create that demand and that uptake of Inflation Reduction Act money. Another thing I'd note is that kind of undoing that distributed generation cap, having good community solar incentives and policies in place, having that storage target, is also really going to work in coordination with that 100% carbon free by 2035 goal. Those things will allow more solar to get into the system and of course increase our generation of renewable capacity.
You know, I guess my follow-up is do you believe that the way Michigan's system is set up now with that cap and with some of those things stopping the implementation of more solar, do you think that that would be a stopping agent, and that do you agree that it would make it more difficult to get some of those grant dollars?
So I think the good news is there is a legislature and a governor very committed to putting in the policies in place that allow the state to leverage that funding. So I don't think at this point, I wouldn't say Michigan is going to be stopped from getting that funding, because there are kind of two periods of applications. One is a notice of intent. So basically Michigan saying, hey, that's funding that we really want to bring down to our state. And then the federal government will look at their application and kind of things they're working on in the state. So having these policies and bills on the table shows is kind of signaling that seriousness to the federal government. And then from there, they would be invited to put in the full application. So we have a little bit of time to get these policies passed. But I would just say the fall is really critical for getting this done, because a lot of those application period or a lot of those notice of intent periods close at the end of September. And then they'll be invited back for those bigger applications. So that time period is really, really critical for getting this done. And I would say having those policies in place will definitely make the state a lot more competitive.
Thursday, August 10th was when this report came out, and Evergreen Action hosted a event to discuss and highlight this report. You specifically said, Courtney, the proposals could slash energy costs for Michigan families by at least $145 annually by the end of the current decade, and could avoid 1,000 premature deaths in the state by 2050 through avoiding pollution. Could you dive in a little bit more about what this means for the everyday family?
Yeah, absolutely. So we know that kind of using those renewable sources of energy, which are lower costs, are just going to save families money. Right now, I think, or in the past year, I guess, we've seen really the volatility of the gas market on full display, kind of with the war going on in Ukraine, and the market kind of being out of flux because of that has really, we saw gas prices and natural gas prices really spike. So having that, those stable, lower cost renewable energy sources will save families money. And that is something that is critically important, especially as Michiganers kind of grapple with frequent rate hikes, and we pay some of the highest costs for electricity in the Midwest, actually countrywide. Those immediate benefits of lower household energy costs are really going to ensure that more people can keep the lights on. And then I would also say, in terms of health, I think this was discussed at the event too, but I think Senator Chang was talking about how in her district in Detroit, there's a disproportionate impact of pollution on Black and brown communities that live there because of the pollutive power plants, the pollutive industrial activity happening there. That would create immediate benefits for those communities, just having those lower carbon sources.
You know, when I hear about this report and I think about the money available, I can't help but think about the DTE energy settlement that was reached fairly recently with multiple organizations, including some of DTE's most vocal critics, to end its use of coal in 2032, speeding up closure and repurposing of its remaining coal power plants. If you already see this coming from some of Michigan's major utilities, are you concerned that one might raise the question of, you know, why do we need to speed through policy when we already have some really big players in our state answering the call?
Yeah, I think the DTE settlement is a big step in the right direction of the kind of timelines we need to be thinking about for shutting down fossil fuel plants. I would say at the same time, like trend wise, we are still seeing nationally utilities still invest in these natural gas resources. That trend is not conducive with the path we need to be going. So I would say, though that settlement is a step in the right direction, there is still a lot of work to be done in terms of setting utilities up, setting municipal utilities up, rural co-ops that provide electricity in Michigan to really take advantage of these incentives that exist and transition to renewable sources, because there's never been more funding on the table to do it.
Sort of honing in on that settlement as well, because, you know, that's something that I've seen pretty plastered across the news in the past few weeks. But I'm curious, you know, if there's any one thing that stands out to you in terms of a big step forward within that.
Yeah, I would say, I mean, there were so many pieces of that settlement, and I wasn't involved in the actual legal case. So I'm just kind of summarizing the recap that I've read through. But kind of those timelines for getting the coal plants offline are really critical as Michigan works to increase its renewable standard.
Now, you know, I do have a question. When you think about some of the policies that your organization is advocating for, especially when it comes to its impact on commercial, residential, and industrial spaces, should there be penalties for if a company, if an institution can't meet this timeline and its demands?
I think as the governor and the lieutenant governor, I believe, mentioned yesterday, I wouldn't so much think about it as penalties as opportunity. So I think as we kind of see these things being taken advantage of, there's going to be challenges in kind of deploying renewables, right? So we're thinking about things like siting in Michigan. That's a huge problem. Like, it's really hard to get projects sited. It can be hard to connect renewable projects to transmission lines because we haven't built out sufficient transmission in this country. Those kind of things will present implementation challenges for utilities. We still do believe that timeline is very feasible, given that there's funding to kind of do all of these things, to expedite siting, to build out new transmission. By the end of this decade, we think it's really feasible to really increase that target.
Now, when you talk about policies, I mean, there's a lot of legislation at hand. I know that, you know, I kind of summarized the Clean Energy Future Plan, which is Senate Democrats' legislation with some of these clean energy goals. And then we also have HB 4839 and HB 4840 by State Representatives Jen Hill and McKinney, which would offer under the bills residents who individually install solar and battery storage would receive $500 per kilowatt rebates for their solar systems and $300 per kilowatt hour for batteries, with eligible low-income households acquiring double of that aforementioned incentive. But, you know, it seems that there's just a lot of bills here. And what is, like, what you most want to see get approved in the fall? You know, what is the most crucial out of this huge buffet of legislation?
Yeah, I don't want to have a cop-out answer, but definitely all of them. I think yesterday we talked about the ones that are very important for kind of the governance of all of this. So things like reforming the Public Service Commission, that 100% clean energy target, the energy waste reduction target. Those bills kind of work to set the stage for where Michigan's energy sector should be heading. And then all of those bills, things like lifting the cap on distributed generation, getting more community solar online, creating stronger incentives so low-income people can access these low-cost renewable systems, keep the lights on, lower their energy costs, those kind of things work in coordination with these bills. So we can kind of see those three bigger ones that I mentioned as catalysts, and the other ones being really the critical implementation pieces for getting these targets for reaching these targets.
You know, you have additionally mentioned that these policies can add 160,000 jobs over the next 26 years when paired with this IRA investment. What kind of jobs are you imagining?
Yeah, there's so many opportunities now. So things like job growth in, like, for electricians will be huge. Just the work to go into homes and install heat pumps and the incentives that exist for schools to do that. And multifamily homes, hospitals, like, electricians will see huge demand for work in the residential and commercial sector. There's also going to be a ton of work for utility workers on transmission build out installation of new renewable sources and storage, that kind of thing. And then there's also this kind of category of indirect jobs. So communities in Michigan that are hosting a big renewable energy project, the job growth that will be created and the economic and that development in that community will not be just the building out of those projects. It will be the support of the new workers in that community, if that makes sense. So things like service jobs, that hotels, that kind of thing, which we call indirect jobs. Again, you kind of see the knock-on effect of the economic boom around this build out of this decarbonization build out, if you will.
And then when talking about, you know, some of this job growth, I guess the first thing that comes to mind for me and the first thing that I think has been on everyone's minds this summer, you know, at least quite a bit, is population, especially with the creation of the Governor's Population Council. Do you believe that the passage of these big packages of legislation will help the draw of people to Michigan, or do you think it will push some businesses out of the state? What are you looking at or preparing for?
Oh, yeah, I think this is a massive opportunity for the state of Michigan to really attract people back to the state and keep people here. I think that's actually one of the reasons why I'm most kind of excited about what the Inflation Reduction Act is doing with this job growth, is really creating economic booms in parts of the country that have maybe suffered economic decline in the last few decades and population decline. We're seeing states like Michigan, states like Georgia really attract all of these renewable energy projects, which is creating kind of that workforce and that population, and eventually that population growth. So that's something I'm really excited about. I think Michigan is such a key place for this work just because of the history of the auto industry and the move toward vehicle electrification. That kind of thing is naturally going to bring more workers to that space. And the skills and, you know, the union labor that exists in Michigan is so strong that I think Michigan is really like the center of where this boom is going to be happening.
So we're near the end of our segment here today, but my final question for you, Courtney, is, you know, as we stand right now, what is Michigan's biggest Achilles heel when it comes to becoming attractive for these federal dollars?
Yeah, I don't know so much like as an Achilles heel. I think a gap right now is kind of having these targets in place. So I'm really hopeful that those things are going to happen this fall, that 100% target, that increased energy waste reduction, that will really create the demand around this project growth and the takedown of those federal dollars. So I think it's just a matter of getting these policies in place. As we know, like, I think there was the Climate Power report that came out last week shows that the investment and the job growth in Michigan already happening is historic. And we know that layering on state policy is going to kind of double that effect. So that's the gap where we really can address kind of the remaining opportunity.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, a closing remark, I mean, I think what's pretty fascinating about this story here is like now the environmentalists in Michigan have this report that seems to be like a huge piece of ammunition for you guys.
Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. So that's why I think this is just such an important time, because this funding for states has never existed at this level before. So I think, you know, states that had an eye towards this work before, they may have, you know, had been thinking about the financial challenges associated with a massive economic transformation. The federal government, through the Inflation Reduction Act, has kind of taken a little bit of that weight off of states by making this funding available. And now that's going to really work as a catalyst. So we think this report just shows that there's no good reason not to have strong clean energy policies at the state level anymore, especially in Michigan, where there's so much to be gained. So we are hopeful that these numbers are really going to create momentum around these really important policies.
Now, thank you so much, Courtney, for joining us today on the MERS Monday podcast. We greatly appreciate it. And that is going to do it for today's episode of the MERS Monday podcast. Thank you so much to our morning roundtable participants, Executive Director Abby Mitch of Michigan Rising Action, and State Representative Jason Morgan, the Vice President of the Michigan Democratic Party. Additionally, thank you to State Senator Kevin Hertel, the St. Clair Shores Democrat, and Courtney Burgoyne, the Senior Policy and Advocacy Manager for the Midwest Region at Evergreen Action. I also want to give a tremendous thanks thanks to MERS House reporter Danielle James and MERS editor Kyle Malin. Post-production of the MERS Monday podcast is by Mark Bayshore Audio and Okemos. Thanks to him for putting this audio together. Additionally, thank you to AT&T for sponsoring this and all of our other podcasts. Until next time, I am Samantha Schreiber. Stumbling up the stairs to the show.